This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 9th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 174th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today, we'll set foot in the art world of the swinging 60s, courtesy of a new exhibition about the world of the legendary art dealer Robert Fraser.
Dear Robert, enclosed, please find one blank piece of paper, folded. I'll be everlastingly grateful if you will write on it the whereabouts of any Andy Warhol drawings. Terrific regards. I think that sums it up for me.
We'll ask, where does the internet live, as we speak to the artist John Gerard about new works that explore the material part of our increasingly virtual world.
I think it's interesting that one's cloud is actually an object on the landscape in Oklahoma.
And we'll make sure we pack our mittens for a trip to the chilliest music festival yet, up Ottawa way.
It's a part of our life. Like, if you're a band, like, you have to play in the winter, you gotta schlep in the winter, and you gotta still do everything you gotta do in the winter, like make music videos.
Plus, Houston's Museum of Fine Art is gonna have a refurb. We'll ask why and have a wander. We'll also party on in Niger, and we'll have a live Midori House session from Milwaukee Folk Field Report. It's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. This week, we welcome Milwaukee Folkster Field Report into Midori House to play us a few tracks. Chris Porterfield is the man behind the moniker and spent a while playing with Bon Iver before setting off on his own in 2011. Last year, Porterfield released his second record, Marigolden, and from it, here he is with Decision Day.
Now the morning was gilded around the edges with the shavings from bones, and they were pressed and then glued against the corners and carved just like soapstone. And it was gloriously gray. The sun was a radiant underlay. Fighting, fading, winning, waning, burying behind milk and cloud and snow. Now the blinds are up a foot from the bottom, and I can make out outlines of ankles, legs, and asses. Until a fresh set sends blood to my ears, and the memories flood the levee of my boredom. And the final sinewy strand has been cut clean through. There is a pop, a crack, and a thud. You were free, and I am free now to extricate ourselves from the mud. So you practiced your name in the margins of pages of 100,000 rough drafts. Heard they roughed you up pretty bad. You gotta climb up the mountaintop and scream out loud and chip your teeth on a bottle top and do me proud. 'Cause when I held your hand in my blood-free hands, I swear they were the cleanest ones in town. Take your time and let the tide pull you out to sea. Just take your time and let the tide just pull you.
That was Field Report with Decision Day. You know how it works. We'll have more from them and a chat later. First, we're going to Mayfair's Pace Gallery to explore a wonderful, wonderful new show about Robert Fraser, the late great art dealer who changed contemporary art in the 1960s in London by putting on edgy, exotic, esoteric, erotic, ever interesting shows in stuffy old Cork Street, HQ of fine art and sporting prints bought by bowler-hatted businessmen or tweed-clad gents. But Fraser, born high but who lived, thought and loved higher in every sense, hung out with hip young gunslingers, was famously arrested at Keith Richards' Sussex Pile and was immortalised with Mick Jagger and with handcuffs in Richard Hamilton's work Swinging London. Brian Clark was one of Fraser's artists and partners in crime. Harriet Viner wrote a brilliant book called Groovy Bob about Fraser. Brian and Harriet collaborated on A Strong Sweet Smell of Incense at the Pace Gallery, and it's a touching, witty, bright and brilliant collection of works that make a work in themselves, a portrait of Robert Fraser. The duo gave me a tour as the final hang took place amidst a strong, sweet smell of wet paint.
The idea on this particular wall is to somehow try and grasp that will-o'-the-wisp thing that Robert had that put one of his feet in the kind of urban modernity and kind of rock and roll moment, but also that he had another foot that was in a historical past that meant a great deal to him as well, and that nourished him as, you know, as a person, like it can to so many of us. And so to put the Warhol, that such a significant Warhol, on a wall entirely on its own when it's such a small piece, and then run across the wall at the very top, 20 feet from the ground or more, a line of Pugin's metalwork that were salvaged from the House of Commons in 1944 during the bombing. And they're just mounting those now against a warm oak background, because as all your readers know, brass and warm oak are a leitmotif in Augustus Welby Northmore Pugin's work, and Robert would certainly have known that.
We should talk about one of the elephants in the room at this show, which is Richard Hamilton's Swinging London. There are two versions of it. Maybe you can talk us through the significance of these two.
You can't have an exhibition really about Robert Fraser without including this, because it's such a significant and recognisable work of the period, and as far as English pop art is concerned, nothing really carries with it more authority than this painting. And on the left is hung the 1967, the original version, and on the right is a late work that Richard was working on up to 5 days before he died in 2011, and so he revisited that work 50 years later, yeah. I suppose. So the two versions show a lifelong relationship with a great artist and a great gallerist, and it's a collision of cultures, yeah, occurs there, because it's youth being admonished by middle age.
Robert, in a way, came from the old guard, so he's, you know, in that picture, he's with the sort of bright young things, but he's one of the old guard. But for that very reason, he was punished more than the others. Although it must be said, he was the only one with heroin on him. All the rest didn't have drugs at all. But
he abused them all.
There are a lot of different voices, a lot of different works in this show that you and Brian have co-curated. Maybe you could tell us, between the two of you, what the creative process is like, getting all these things in here, deciding where to put them, deciding what stays and what goes.
Well, it was interesting for me because I'd already done Groovy Bob, so that was my portrait, so to speak, of Robert. We knew Robert at the same time, and Brian's a great friend of mine, but his choice of paintings, you know, in a way that was always a surprise to me. And some things, you know, Swinging London, I expected, but I was really thrilled by some of his choices. Somehow the unexpected made Robert come alive even more for me, so I was really thrilled.
The actual exhibition is my portrait of Robert. It's not an academic study of him, and we've purposely avoided any kind of inventorial approach. There are a lot of artists that Robert represented, I mean, great artists like Bridget Riley, who are not really represented in the show beyond a reference. But it's just because in my memory of Robert, she does not play that role. I wasn't there in the 60s. And the 60s artists who were in this played a big role in my particularly kind of eccentric relationship with Robert.
Maybe we can walk around the corner to the sort of cabinet of curiosities and ephemera. There's letters, postcards, ticket stubs, and all the rest of it. I think this might sum up a bit of the atmosphere of the world of Robert Fraser. Maybe we should wander around the corner.
I mean, these are from Robert's archives, and every time you lay them out anywhere, people immediately start looking, even if it's randomly on a table, to sort them out. And every time you find, for example, this one here, this is an early draft of Performance that was in his collection, and that's a letter from James Fox, the actor, James Fox.
When it was called The Performers.
Yes, exactly, an early draft. And this is from the producer, Sandy Lieberson. But somehow you just get a feel, you know, of all those fascinating things he was around at the time. And also, this is my particular favourite. Very simple, very says it all somehow, which is from the Pasadena Art Museum. Dear Robert, enclosed, please find one blank piece of paper, folded. I will be everlastingly grateful if you will write on it the whereabouts of any Andy Warhol drawings. Terrific regards. I think that sums it up for me. But another thing that might sum it up is further down here, which is Brian's brother very kindly donated this Robert Fraser's treasured opium pipe.
Oh, wow. Well, this is kind of one of the key exhibits, right? Or should I say key pieces of evidence, right? And there are the pictures on the left-hand side. I presume these aren't going to be hung. This is to give the effect that it's a working gallery and these are coming and going.
Exactly. You've got it in one. A working gallery, not reproductions. These are the real thing. A Colin Self hot dog, very iconic. Yeah. Dubuffet, a Hockney, the Jan Haworth poster from the Times, and an Ellsworth Kelly and Andy Warhol balloons. What Brian's saying is, you know, this is a working gallery, reproduction of a working gallery, and I think these artists would be thrilled to be put down there in that fashion.
We're looking above this cabinet of curiosities at a very busy wall.
Yeah, I mean, the things are hung cheap my jowl, and they in what used to be called a salon hang, I think. And so you've got a rather grubby, kind of decayed, never mind the bollocks poster by Jamie Reed from 76, I guess that is, above an Andy Warhol disaster picture, one of the car crashes, next to Klaus Oldenburg's drawing from 63 for The Home, which Robert exhibited, and above 61 Hockney, Doll Boy, which is up close to a Colin Self double portrait of brilliant draftsmanship, which is below 1949 Francis Bacon. I'm trying, by putting posters and paintings of great preciousness together, to remove that kind of inevitable thing that we have these days, oh, it must be worth that so much money and must have such fiscal value. So just to take it back to kind of the kind of fresh oxygenating value that it had in Robert's time. And these are things that Robert all had a connection with one way or another.
Do you have a responsibility to anything other than your own memory? Do you have to try to factor in what people might think of it at all? No. Or do you not care?
Couldn't give a fuck. it's my portrait of Robert, like it or not. And, you know, if somebody else wants to do a portrait of Robert, I think that would be interesting and I'd certainly want to see it. But this is my portrait of Robert, so asking anybody else what they think about it or doing research into the historical exactitude of it would be counterproductive to the artistic impulse. It's just an artistic thing. It's just the kind of thing Robert would have liked.
Well, that was my question. That's my last question. This is to you both.
Yeah.
Is this the sort of show that Robert Fraser would have done himself?
One thing I'm pretty confident about is that there's nothing in the show that Robert wouldn't have enjoyed.
And this is Brian's portrait of Robert, so if Robert did a portrait of Brian, that would be a very different kettle of fish, I'm sure. But he would see the point of this, and I'm sure he would love it.
And that show is quite transporting and absolutely evocative of its time. A strong sweet smell of incense is on at Pace on Burlington Gardens until the end of March. Canada's capital, Ottawa, is known as the coldest capital in the world, and it's typically also known for being a boring government town with mountains of snow in the winter and the largest ice rink in the world. So why on earth would anyone launch a new music showcase festival in February? We sent our Canadian reporter Mars Sellers to Megafono, Ottawa's first music business conference and showcase festival, to find out.
I really like the Tuesday to Thursday, middle of winter, minus 25 Celsius today, I think it is. I mean, it's for the hardcores only.
Welcome to Ottawa, hometown to Alanis Morissette, half of Arcade Fire, Paul Anka, Metz, and Colorado. Like many Canadian cities, Ottawa produces talented artists who then pick up and move to a bigger market, such as Toronto, Vancouver, or Montreal. Kelp Records founder John Bartlett is attempting to change all that by bringing in a bit of infrastructure to the local scene. His first step, Ottawa's first music industry conference and showcase festival, Megafono.
Well, Megafono started out as a sort of sync licensing arm of our record label, Kelp Records. And last year, we decided to change our focus and really focus on trying to build Ottawa music industry, support Ottawa artists, and help people make connections, both in the city and abroad. We've got a really small, tiny music industry here in Ottawa, so the whole point is to build it and bring people from away to see. We're really proud of the artists that are here, and we want to help them get new opportunities. We are a festival city. We have a ton of great music festivals. This isn't meant to be another music festival. It's meant really, I mean, the business side of it is important, and it's really trying to push that agenda and give people those opportunities that don't happen here on the industry side. So bringing in labels, bringing in booking agents, bringing in music supervisors, and just exposing them to Ottawa, Ottawa, Ottawa music.
And part of that exposure includes wacky venues and winter sports. The first night started in a church and ended in a pinball pierogi bar with an ice skate down the Rideau Canal, the world's largest ice rink. Leslie Marshall, one of the Megafono organizers, took 8 of us delegates to skate between venues, a typical way of commuting in Ottawa during winter. What made you want to include this as part of the festival?
Well, we had these guests from coming out of town, and we just thought, this is something that we like to do, and it's pretty fun, but it's kind of extreme. So.
Especially after people have had a few drinks, and it's like late at night.
Absolutely, but that kind of adds to the edge of it. And it just so happened that 2 of our venues were connected by the canal, so how could we not?
Do you think this is big in the Ottawa music scene, that people who like music like skating?
Well, there's a couple of music videos that have been inspired by it, like New Swear's video for a song off their album, Funny Isn't Real. They shot a whole huge video on the canal. It's a part of our life. Like, you always, as your band, like, you have to play in the winter, you gotta schlep in the winter, and you gotta still do everything you gotta do in the winter, like make music videos.
This
If you thought skating between music venues was fun, the next evening we got driven out to the Diefenbunker, a nuclear bomb shelter built in 1959 by then Prime Minister Diefenbaker during the height of the Cold War. Six stories underground, I watched bands playing in the old bank vault, which was supposed to keep Canada's gold reserves safe from radiation. Here I met Matthias Menouze, Ottawa Showbox founder, an online news, reviews, and listening site covering the city's diverse music scene.
I think it's really important for this kind of festival to happen because Ottawa's at a point right now where, you know, we have so many good acts and so many different genres that are, you know, punk or electronic or pop, whatever it is. I think that Ottawa's at that point now that we need this kind of thing to happen, like Megafono, to showcase all those talents and to really bring them all together.
So what's holding Ottawa back? Rachel Weldon of Debaser, a college radio host and local promoter.
It's something that people have said, like it's reiterated over and over, that there's a real lack of mid-sized venues in Ottawa. So there's just not that level of artists. There's not those, like people, someone could go to the Scotiabank Place if they can sell out like, you know, 3,000 seats or whatever. But if you want a venue that's more than 150 people and less than 3,000, then you're out of luck.
That seems to be the general theme of the festival, that Ottawa is missing venues of a certain size and type. There's also a report due out in March entitled Connecting Ottawa Music, compiled by local musician Andrew Vincent, researcher Ian Swain, and a few City of Ottawa staff members. One of the biggest problems the report identifies is the lack of record labels, management companies, publishers, and booking agents to help connect Ottawa artists to the rest of the music industry. It's a huge gap, which has held Ottawa's music industry back from being as successful as similar-sized Canadian cities such as Winnipeg, Calgary, Edmonton, Hamilton, and Quebec City. Last week's Megafono was definitely a step in the right direction, but the city seems to have a long way yet to go. For Monocle in Ottawa, I'm Mar Sellers.
Brrr, thanks, Mar. After the break, we'll be meeting the artist John Gerard. He'll be talking us through his amazing new show that shows us the invisible. You'll know what I mean when we get there, I promise.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now we're going to get into some really interesting territory. Where is the internet? Where do those zeros and ones and search terms and images and everything end up or start or exist during their transient lives? And are they transient lives or are they stuck somewhere, crystallized to come back and haunt us? I hope I'm not oversimplifying the quite astonishing work of the artist John Gerard by saying that these are surely some of his concerns. For one new work, Gerard asked Google if he could visit and photograph one of their data farms in Oklahoma. Huge quasi-industrial facilities that house acres of servers, generators, coolers, pipes, wires, information, bits of you and me, maybe. Google said no, so he photographed the site from a helicopter in order for he and a team of technicians to make a perfect rendering, including the angle of the sun, moon and stars of the place. A virtual reality, unpopulated but buzzing with strange potential and secrecy. The second work is a solar power station in Nevada that looks like pilgrims circling Mecca's Kaaba. There's power, mystery and strange beauty in both of these works that really need to be seen. John Gerard, however, is wonderful at talking about these complex and powerful works. Here's the man himself.
This is one of seven of these enormous facilities on the landscape in America. There's three in Europe. So, you know, as an active user of Google services, access my emails, navigate through the city, it's quite likely that I'm actually implicated in this site. And what I've always been interested in is less politics, in a sense, or less identity, in a sense, and more materials, you know. And I would judge energy and power to be very much a material. So this is a building rooted on the Oklahoma landscape, you know, which I have a relationship to personally, which is then driving data using local electricity to, you know, facilitate different activities that I'm involved in. So I wanted to make a portrait of it.
In a virtual world, you've made something physical. You've charted the physical reality of that, that everything virtual has to have a physical manifestation at some point.
People's relationship to data is informed by terminology to a degree. I mean, you have these think tanks that come up with terms like the cloud. And the cloud is an interesting term because it has a sort of semi-divine implication. You know, it's sort of ethereal and otherworldly. And this is actually the cloud. I mean, the cloud is a sort of industrial monolith on the landscape. And that's interesting in some ways. But more fundamentally, what people think of as data is originating on the landscape and has to be generated. It doesn't exist, to use a rather unfortunate term of phrase. It exists, it's physical. So I think it's interesting that one's cloud is actually an object on the landscape in Oklahoma.
When you walk into a gallery and you see the name of the work is called Farm and then it says, comma, Oklahoma, there's a nice idea of some sort of Steinbeck or some Midwest in kind of traditional America. Are you wanting to do precisely that, to take visitors to the gallery on a bit of a trip and defeat their expectations with the naming of a work like this?
Well, I mean, I think Oklahoma farming is, you know, in a sense, that's quite a kind of tragic legacy, the Steinbeck legacy, you know, to do with displacements of the Dust Bowl and these things. And it's now a landscape that's industrially farmed for the most part, you know, be it corn. So the term farm in this instance is ambiguous because, you know, I as a member of the public consume the services that emerge from this environment. But what's kind of postmodern about it is that I am also simultaneously consumed in the way that one would not necessarily historically be consumed in a farm environment. And by that I mean that my usage of the facility provides the company with its you know, modus operandi in terms of income, because that is then commercialized. So it's the farm that both sort of eats and you know, eats us while we eat it.
Despite the fact we've never seen this place until we walk into the gallery here, there's a little bit of all of us tied up in this place potentially.
Well, I would be very surprised if there wasn't. But, you know, that's a speculation. But given the 115 billion search terms that I think these facilities are dealing with monthly, there's probably a little trace of us all in there somewhere. This space is dedicated to a work called Solar Reserve, which is a portrait of a solar-powered electricity-generating plant in Nevada. So what it is it's a found object, again, on the American landscape. It's got a curious history with land art, in a sense, because it's a great disc. It's about 10 square kilometers. That disc is made up of what's known as a heliostat, which is Helios was the god of the sun. And heliostat is an animated array of mirrors. Each one is motorized, and there's a central computer that tracks the sun from dawn until dusk every day, allowing the mirrors to throw the rays of the sun to the top of this tower, where it boils salt and in so doing generates electricity.
I mean, this is a physically very beautiful thing. Something about the geometry, the reflectiveness, as you say, it's almost a piece of land art in its scale. It's almost a piece of decorative art in its accidental beauty, I suppose. But the thing that it shares with the other work is that idea that you're trying to capture the essence of the impossible somehow, that capturing the essence and the energy of the sun and then rendering it in a computer image. Is that something that's always interested you, the idea of trying to capture the impossible somehow?
Well, you know, the sun is the original power source, and, you know, the worship of the sun lays, you know, the undercurrents to do with the worship of the sun lay under many of our belief systems, whether we know it or not. And, you know, our conscious relation to time is informed solely by the sun. I mean, our solar orbit gives us our sense of the year.
And this thing looks to me like the Kaaba in Mecca, and it looks like the Hajj. There are artworks or just simple bits of photojournalism which remind me of that. That's what I first thought when I walked into the room. Is that a happy accident for you, that it actually almost looks like it could be something that pertains to religion?
Well, I mean, as it happens, that great disc also in its layout mimics the layout of a sunflower, because all of the seeds in a sunflower follow these sort of golden mean, you know, these fractal golden arcs. And in so doing, they are most effective in absorbing the energy of the sun. So, you know, the accidental similarity to Mecca is, I think, a cultural and emotional echo. And the interconnections between all these things, I think it's perhaps for somebody else to unpick, you know, kind of to be critically unpicked. What I do know for sure is that the sun rises in the east, and all of these mirrors will turn to the rising sun, in a sense, sort of bowing towards them, and then follow it until it goes down in the west. You know, and there's a devotional relationship, and I think that devotional relationship, because they are seeking something from this power source, you know, they're seeking to strip its energy and convert it into electricity. You know, one asks the questions of, you know, why do you have 10,000 pilgrims facing towards this ambiguous structure of the Kaaba, and what is it? People actually don't know what's in there. It might be a meteorite, for all anybody knows, or a fragment of a meteorite. But people are looking for something, potentially, and in so doing, they face the source of power. So that is the unifying thread across the two objects. Whether they relate to each other is not something that I can judge, but they certainly have a kind of almost a physical dynamic which unites them, which is, I think, part of the effect of the work, perhaps part of my reasons for being drawn to it. The more fundamental underlying and much more ancient symbol would be the Celtic spiral, which is carved into Stonehenge. And that is one of the original symbols for the sun, which is an energy curve moving into a spiral. And this also is found in the Spiral Jetty, which is not so far from here, and in this object. So, you know, there's many echoes in this solar disk, which is part of the reason I remade it as a simulation.
That was John Gerard on his new exhibition, Farm, at Thomas Dane Gallery in London. And you can catch that until the 21st of March. Coming up in the second half of the show, more music from Field Report. We head to a music festival on a pontoon on the River Niger, and we find out what's in store for Houston's Museum of Fine Arts as it undergoes a mega makeover. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now for another track from this week's Midori House session from Field Report. In a moment, we'll hear from main man Chris Porterfield in conversation with Monocle's Tom Hall. But for now, here he is performing Michelle.
Oh, Michelle, I'm coming down to see you. Tonight is bruised black, swelling gold and green. And I was in bed, but I had the dream again. Where I drive us off the cliff to the ravine, and the car was Shelby blue, blue like the one in the photo of your father and you, blue like the label on the beer you always choose, blue like me and you, Michelle. Oh, Michelle, I went looking for the river, but I only made it to the railroad bed. There were these candles there, and some days ago cut flowers for the guy who had been knifed there by his friend. And my eyes could not adjust to the flames against the leaves. Someone was watching from nearby. And I heard a phone chime from shallow in the trees. I had to come see you, Michelle. Thank you. Oh, Michelle, we are trafficking in wonder, worshipping the wounds upon your cheek. Just kiss me shy and I will love you like a lamprey in the cool, cool water in the creek. Tornadoes transform and leave us changed, and everyone we love will break on us like waves. So take your hands and cover up your eyes and your face. Tell me what you see now, Michelle. Oh, Michelle, first light might come too late, so let's outdrive the headlights and the stars. 'Cause the roof, it held, but only till the rain fell. Now it's leaking love inside my captain's car. And I tossed my chevrons out the window on the way over here. Uncle Sam can meet me by the tree line. He and I and your husband, we can work it out like men. We won't end up eye to eye. I can't say the things that I've seen from the time that I was gone and then returned. But I got 5,000 bucks and a full tank of gas and a Stars and Stripes beach towel with a cigarette burn. If we leave right now, we'll be there by morning. There being anywhere but here. We can make a new start. We can make up new names. I've already picked yours, Michelle.
We're joined now by Chris Porterfield of Field Report, who I guess we could call it a one-man band that also has a band. Is that how Field Report works?
It's, you know, it continues to reveal. When I started calling it Field Report, I wanted it to be a band. But being a band, it takes a lot of time. And so I have since lost all of the original members of Field Report. I'm the last one standing. But yes, we write and perform with Shane Leonard and Tom Winsack as well.
I read that the way you kind of approach songwriting is you're very much into the lyrics and the words, almost not necessarily more, but I think some songwriters definitely just go straight for the music and then add words.
Yeah. For this project, it typically starts with words.
Yeah.
And then once there's something, there's a story to be told or some kind of thing that I'm chasing after idea-wise, once that's in a place where I think it's worthy of taking the next step, then we'll start scoring it.
Yeah. And the latest album, Marigolden, that's a sort of strange portmanteau. What does that word mean to you?
Yeah, it was just a word. Doing this for a job, I try to be sensitive to words and ideas when they come. And while we were in the studio making this thing, this word just sort of stumbled out, and it just sounded kind of lovely. And when you unpack it, it kind of tells the story on its own. A marigold is sort of this hardy flower, can withstand the cold to some degree, but sooner or later you have to dig it up because it dies, and then replant it if you'd like it. It's rather stinky. It's not particularly floral or perfumey. It's got its own sort of musk to it.
I don't really know my flowers too well.
Do they have marigolds here?
I don't know. Maybe we can get a professional opinion on that. I'm not totally sure about that. But
Control room says no. Marigold gloves.
Oh yeah, of course. Sure. We've just been informed by our producer about marigold washing up gloves. I don't know. Do you have those in the US?
I don't believe so.
You know, like yellow washing up gloves.
Oh
like,
right, like, yeah, to like, do the dishes or
yeah,
something.
They're called marigolds, I guess, because of the color.
Okay, like, that would make sense.
So maybe that's what your album is actually about.
Yeah, it's all about doing chores.
Yeah, of course.
Which is kind of true. And then juxtaposing the idea of something being golden or somehow blessed or, you know, rising to the top or giving off warmth or light or something. But actually, it's just, you know, doing the dishes and scrubbing the bathroom or the washroom or the toilet or the loo.
It's not just a sort of folky sound, though, the album. Some of the kind of textures and stuff kind of creep up on you in songs. Like one of the songs, I think Wings, like has this kind of almost like Brian Eno ambient sort of center, you know. I'm interested because I see that you're playing dates with Tweedy of Wilco, Jeff Tweedy. Mm-hmm. That's almost quite a kind of Wilco thing, like sneaking that kind of strange avant-garde noises into maybe more traditional kind of country-esque songs. Have those guys ever been much of an influence? Or if not, who else has been an influence on your sound?
Yeah, Wilco has certainly been an influence. We're both from the American Midwest, sort of writing folk songs at the core, but finding interest and excitement in other kinds of music as well and incorporating that into what we do. So yeah, it's going to be a real pleasure supporting Tweedy on these shows. And this is actually our first time in the UK. And so I think it's going to be a nice way to frame what we do for a new audience. I respect the career and the body of work that that band has built.
That was Chris Porterfield, a.k.a. Field Report, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall, a.k.a. Monocle's Tom Hall. You can catch him and his band live across the US throughout February. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. Mali's prettiest city is called Ségou. Just under 250 kilometres from the bustling capital Bamako, Ségou sits quietly on the southern bank of the Niger River. Every year in February, the people of Ségou put a large pontoon in the waters of the river, build a stage on top, and invite Mali's best and most popular artists to play. It's called the Festival on the Niger, and now in its 11th year, it attracts music aficionados from around the world. Bram Posthumus is a regular visitor, and over the weekend, he attended this year's edition, and here is what he heard.
Welcome to the noisy, bustling grounds of the Festival sur le Niger. Now in its 11th year, the festival attracts all kinds of people. From these three fellows from Burkina Faso, trying out their English.
Very nice.
His name is Jeliba.
Where?
To this lady from the Republic of Niger, selling aphrodisiacs. And they're all here to see the wealth of wonderful music on offer at the festival. We are, after all, in Mali, and in spite of all the bad press the country has been getting of late, armed conflict, kidnappings, religious intolerance, as far as the music goes, you will still be hard-pressed to find a better place pretty much anywhere. This man knows something about that.
Hey y'all, my name's Jacante. I'm here in West Africa at the Ségou Festival. I'm a musician from California, New Orleans, with a band, Jacante and the Mali All-Stars, and we have a project here called Mali Blues in West Africa, and we play all over the place.
Jacante, who works under his artist name of Jacante, came to the northern city of Timbuktu in 2009. After two tragedies happened in his life, in quick succession. He went to Mali in search of his soul, as he puts it. He came back with a musical education.
It's really interesting, you know, if you trace the history of the blues, it comes from these deep West African roots. So it's only natural as a rocking, you know, harmonica player / New Orleans blues type player like myself, you know, the mecca of the blues is here.
But it's not just blues and the many Malian musical styles that you will find on stage here in Ségou. How about Afrobeat? And this time not done by a copycat band from London, Amsterdam or New York, but by a young woman from Guinea. Her name is Siatono. Born in Guinea's forest region close to the border with Sierra Leone, she grew up in Freetown, the Sierra Leonean capital. But in the 1990s, she had to run for her life as the country's civil war reached her city. She fled to Guinea and then survived for years, singing cover tunes in the bars and cabarets of the capital, Conakry.
I didn't lead a womanly life. I have been in the street, I didn't learn my music in the school. I learned it in the street. These are the images we give to boys. When I look at myself at the mirror, is I see a young boy, a man, now a man, a full-grown man. And when I decide to be a woman, I become very dangerous.
So entering the very male world of Afrobeat was not particularly daunting for Siatolno.
Afrobeat, since Fela, portrays that part of helping Africa to get out of the bad image we've been given. When I listened to Afrobeat the first time, I said, this should be my music. Afrobeat was just this, it's the center of all I need musically. Because when you listen to Afrobeat, you can find the African music, the jazz, the blues, the hip-hop, the funk, the rock.
The music plays, the market heaves with people buying and selling, the restaurants are bursting and the drinks flow until very late. But this is 1 week for the whole year. What about the other 51?
Bon, en état aussi ségouvien, je vous parle.
This is Anise Kiberudena, the owner of the Hambe Hotel on the edge of Ségou's city center. His place is home to the best late-night jam sessions this festival has to offer. But he also feels the event's impact can be improved by getting more local youths and other people involved and offering a larger economic footprint to help Ségou's struggling tourism industry to survive until the next festival rolls around. And he's living by example, serving food that's grown locally and getting his fruit drinks from a Bamako-based female-run enterprise. But the best thing about his place is the view on the river. Oh, and those sessions. The music goes on until dawn. Jekonte joined the impromptu band, as did this young Malian guitar player, Ben Zabo. He burnt up the main stage on the closing night of the festival. Ben Zabo talks about the deep political crisis that caused the suspension of the festival on the Niger for 1 year in 2013.
My new album is called Our Great Mali. It's about this crisis, which isn't over yet. I appeal to everyone to save Mali and help us get out of this mess.
The politics of Mali can be complicated, but with musicians and festivals like these, Mali may just be able to dance its way to safety. For Monocle, in Ségou, I'm Bram Posthumus.
Thanks, Bram. After the break, we'll be speaking to the creative force behind the redevelopment of Houston's Museum of Fine Arts.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Last month, the Museum of Fine Arts Houston officially launched its $450 million redevelopment programme at an event in New York. The museum's 14-acre campus will be overhauled with 2 new buildings from Stephen Hall Architects, including a new Glassell School of Art. The work is expected to be completed by 2019 as the Texan city, one of the fastest growing and most ethnically diverse in the United States, begins to flex its cultural muscles. Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, spoke to architect Stephen Hall alongside Gary Tintero, the museum's director who previously forged his career at the Met. First up, Gary.
I was lured to Houston by the opportunity. I mean, big skies, open spaces, and Texas is right now a land of opportunity. The city of Houston is growing enormously. The economy until recently has been very, very strong. And our museum in the last 10 years has had a number of bequests and received great works of art that have transformed that museum into one of the world's great museums. And so the idea of coming to work with those resources was irresistible.
Talking of world's great museums, how would you rate the Museum of Fine Arts, perhaps inside of America? How do you think it ranks in terms of great cultural institutions?
We're around 6 or 7 in terms of the big municipal museums in the country. We're number 3 in terms of our resources. Our wealth, our endowment is 3rd in the country. But if you look at the size of our collections and our facilities, when we're done, we'll be 5 or 6. Right now, we might be 7.
What do you want to do with the campus in Houston? What do you want to make it become?
Well, what I very much hope to do is restore the original urban plan that was designed now a century ago and has been sullied by parking lots, by a number of urban planners. We're bringing it back to what it was essentially meant to be, a pedestrian zone adjacent to our great university, our great park, our great medical center, and to be truly a cradle of culture. And so we're going to be providing all kinds of amenities for pedestrians to visit our campus, see our facilities, our 6 buildings, our indoor and outdoor theaters, our amphitheater, our rooftop sculpture garden, our ground level sculpture garden, our 25 new galleries that we're building for the display of modern and contemporary art, lectures, etc. It's the programming of the campus that I hope will be the legacy for the future.
Tell me, obviously, beyond the fact that you're going to have these cutting-edge buildings, what's it going to bring to the Museum of Fine Arts?
We're increasing the space for the display of art by 50%. We're increasing our art school by some 40%. We're going to increase the amenities that we offer our visitors by 100%. We're going to have these beautiful park-like settings, great crosswalks, underground parking, indoor, outdoor, theater, restaurants, etc. We really are going to be this great cultural destination where people can come for the day and not only visit our facilities, but those of neighboring institutions, Asian Society Texas, Children's Museum, Contemporary Arts Museum. We're going to be Houston's hub for all things cultural.
So, Stephen, tell me a little bit the thinking, the ideas behind the buildings you designed.
The project really is important to me because it's an entire campus. It isn't just a single building. And that came about because the nature of the competition was the brief asked for the first phase to be a 10-story parking garage. And we said, no, what you should do is put parking underground in 2 layers over the whole site. Therefore, you have to build a new Glassell school, move it back, and you could expand and double the size of the sculpture garden. For me, that was the crucial point, you know, that they could accept the fact that I wouldn't follow their brief, that I would actually propose this other route for them. And that's why it's been 3 years until we can unveil this.
You've talked about this as the most important project you'll ever do as an architect. Why is that?
I really cherish doing art museums. I think I feel like the museum today, you know, is a social condenser. Maybe the church was 100 years ago, but the museum today is a kind of social condenser. It's a place where people come together. And this isn't just a museum, this is a campus. So I have that dimension of the social condenser of the community, but I also have the urban space. And I think for me also, art, their collection is superb and it has enormously interesting dimensions to it and it's growing. And art is a way into the core values of life today, more than maybe any other discipline. It has the possibility to lead us into the poetic contemplation of what it means to be human, what it means to exist on this earth. There's so many dimensions, especially a number of younger artists connecting to various aspects of our time on this earth. So for me, to be able to create a facility for that discipline, but also to be able to make it as an urban space and connect it urban layers, it's a very rare opportunity.
I mean, you've worked a lot with art centers or cultural centers and also educational centers. If we can group the two together, what are the sort of challenges as an architect that throws up?
Pleasing all the curators is a challenge. Many different attitudes in terms of how art should be exhibited and how it's thought of. And I think it's important to reach a balance in that regard. And I think that's, in every case, different. You're dealing with different people and different philosophical positions on the experience of art.
That was architect Stephen Hall, who's working on the redevelopment of Houston's Museum of Fine Arts, speaking to Ed Stocker. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. Talk about Google's secrets. She's like the Sphinx herself. Time for one final song from this week's Midori House session. Here is Field Report with Pale Rider. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
There's a pale horse outside my door. In my dream, where my dream horse usually goes. told me its name, it's the same as yours. I've been so worried about you. 'Cause there's something inside you've been clouding your head. Like a mother and expecting to be soon again. But the thing inside you is not your kin. It's a ghost you let keep haunting. And I don't know that I can be your place to go or what you need. I don't know that I can be your place to go or what you need. Now the next thing I know, I'm on your back with the suitcase full of the wrong things packed. Where I looking for your family but doubling back to every bar we chose to pass on. Now you're cantering crooked and screaming at the wind, shooting off flare guns in memory of the kid. His birthday was yesterday, he would have been 6. Oh my God, I am so sorry. I don't know that I can be your place to go or what you need. I don't know that I can be your place to go or what you need. Told me its name, it's the same as yours.